What a difference a year makes. Last June, Philip Morris stock price was struggling to get back above $50, depressed by a sense that this once great company had somehow lost its way. To many, the company seemed to be ill-equipped to fight off the multiple threats of new class action suits, much higher excise taxes, regulation by an overzealous FDA commissioner, and a badly tarnished public opinion, fueled daily, it seemed, by a hostile press intent on putting cigarettes into the graveyard with asbestos. 1 year later, Philip Morris has beaten back these multiple threats and prospered. Under new CEO Jeffrey Bible, this company appears to be doing everything right. The Marlboro juggernaut gains share almost at will, both domestically and overseas, and the company continues to sell off food assets that don't deliver on growth or return objectives. Shareholders have roundly applauded. Since last June, Philip Morris stock price is up 20% relative to the market, despite a continuing tough litigation environment. We look for earnings growth in the 15% range for the foreseeable future. Do it out. Okay, well, never mind. The challenges facing Philip Morris, of course, remain. Will the current litigation wave once again prove benign, as in the past, or will the new class action claims finally pummel the industry? Will Philip Morris' substantial share gains in domestic tobacco and RJR's equally dramatic share losses undermine the fragile peace that was created in the wake of Marlboro Friday? And finally, can Philip Morris International Tobacco Business continue to dazzle investors with 15% profit growth in the face of price adjustments by competitors and state monopolies who seem unwilling to give up more share? We are very pleased to have with us today Mr. Jeffrey Bible, Philip Morris Chairman and Chief Executive Officer, and Mr. Murray Bring, Philip Morris General Counsel and protector of this audience's collective $60 billion plus investment. Jeff and Murray, welcome.
Okay. I'll take it. Yeah, boy, I've handled that one. Well, thanks, Gary, and good morning. The most remarkable thing about Philip Morris is not our size or the fact that we are the fifth most profitable company in the United States. What is extraordinary is that we are continuing to grow rapidly. Our objectives are simple: to increase our earnings by growing our businesses, which generates the cash to achieve our overarching objective, to increase shareholder value. For the foreseeable future, we should achieve our first objective with superior annual increases in earnings. And that, in turn, should fuel continued improvement in shareholder value. Our business growth is driven by two key assets: our powerful portfolio of premium food, beer and tobacco brands, supported by our proven marketing savvy and our incomparable worldwide infrastructure. Our superior premium brands enjoy strong positions in growing and highly profitable businesses around the world. I've said this before, but no other company can make such a statement, and it's a great sign of our enormous potential. Last year, we had 66 brands that each generated more than $100 million in operating revenues, and several of these generated billions of dollars. And then there's Marlboro, in a class by itself, the most valuable brand in the world. We are building our brands by going where the growth is. We are focusing our business on rapidly growing and profitable segments of our key categories, such as cheese, innovative beers, an American blend, and low-tar cigarettes around the world. Our second major asset is our incomparable worldwide infrastructure. We are constantly building, improving, and expanding our global business to strengthen our marvelous brands for further earnings growth. For example, we are improving our product portfolio and expanding our geographic reach through relatively small, selective acquisitions, and we are continuing to divest non-core operations that don't meet our rigorous margin and growth standards. Turning to our growth plans for each of our businesses, beginning with worldwide food, we expect Kraft's strong operations to deliver steadily improving income growth beginning this year. Just take a look at the largest single source of our food income, coffee. In Europe, the source of almost three-quarters of our coffee income, we have more than 25% of the total market, making us the number one player by a wide margin. And unlike our competitors, we are strong in both major industry segments, that is, roast and ground coffee and soluble coffee. In North American coffee, we are turning in a very good performance this year, focusing on the more profitable, higher-margin segments of the business. Our total share is up more than a full point, and more importantly, our improved product mix is driving strong income gains. Cheese is our second largest income producer in food. This is another growing business. Our worldwide income was up 13% last year, and it is continuing to advance this year. In the U.S., our largest market, consumption has been growing steadily and is up again this year. And we have a vastly superior and growing share position. Our branded cheese volume is up 5% this year through April, and more importantly, profits and margins are showing good growth. Internationally, Philadelphia brand cream cheese, the share leader in more than 30 markets in cream cheese, is continuing to gain volume around the world, even in established markets like Germany, Italy, and the United Kingdom. Confectionery is another outstanding business with terrific potential. We are already one of the largest confectionery companies in Europe, where our total Milka chocolate brand franchise outsells its competitors by wide margins. Our most important strategy for improving the profitability and growth of our food operations is to continue to launch innovative new products in the premium end of the business. Last year, products introduced since 1992 generated overseas retail sales of more than $750 million and rang up $2 billion in North American retail sales. 2 months ago, in recognition of our new product successes, Prepared Foods Magazine named Kraft the new product company of the year and called Kraft a study in how a food industry giant can be nimble and innovative. New products have been key factors behind the rapid growth of Post cereals in North America, which is a higher margin, faster growing business than Kellogg and General Mills. And we've sparked a remarkable turnaround at Oscar Mayer with innovative new products such as Lunchable Fun Packs. We're also first to market with fat-free hot dogs, which are selling even better than our original ambitious expectations. And we are expecting continued double-digit income growth from Oscar Mayer this year. We are supporting our premium brand equity by increasing our investment in advertising around the world, both in dollars and as a percent of its revenue. As all of you will appreciate, advertising is key to brand building, and our commitment to effective advertising has made us a leader in consumer marketing. We are also improving our food operations by refining our business portfolio, increasing our efficiency, and expanding geographically. To improve our North American food portfolio, we have sold declining non-core businesses such as food service distribution with aggregate margins of less than 1% and income of about $100 million, and the divestitures are continuing. As you can see, we then traded these less profitable operations for businesses with much better margins, averaging 16%, and with higher income as well, and that income is growing by an average of 14%. To increase our efficiency, we are planning to take still more costs out of the system with new initiatives in both the U.S. and Europe. Our sales force unification in the United States is already well underway. Our reported worldwide operating margins from food have grown dramatically since we acquired Kraft in 1988, and we lead our broad-based principal competitors on an ongoing basis. Given our size and broad product portfolio, we think that that is fantastic, and we expect further margin improvements over the next few years. Finally, we are also building our portfolio for the future by expanding geographically at a rapid pace. For example, benefiting from the infrastructure of our tobacco business in Latin America, our food income in the region has soared from some $25 million 4 years ago to more than $100 million last year, and we expect income gains there to average more than 15% over the next 5 years. One reason for our confidence in our food business is that our investments in renewed growth in North America are paying off. For example, in Canada, our market shares were growing in only 5 of our 27 categories last year at this time. This year, backed by better marketing and measures taken to lower price gaps, our shares are growing in 15 of our categories. We have also engineered a sharp recovery in dry desserts in the United States, with Jell-O volume up 9% through April and market share up about 3 points. Internationally, consumer spending in Europe is still soft, and this is hurting the European food industry. However, a good number of our grocery categories, such as dry dinners and dressings in Germany, are doing very well, just as similar staples did well during the recession here in the United States. We are now expecting full-year international income growth in food to be in line with growth in our North American food business. We feel very good about the future of our international food operations as we build critical mass, expand and transfer products into new geographies, and continue to take costs out of the business. Adding it all up, Kraft's worldwide food business generates tremendous cash flow. After capital expenditures, our cumulative cash flow from food amounted to $6.7 billion over the past 5 years. On a comparable basis, among food and beverage companies, only Coca-Cola has been higher, and not by much. And let me say again, this is just our food cash flow. What's more, we expect our strong brands, leveraged by more efficient worldwide operations, to more than double last year's annual cash flow from food by the turn of the century. Now to one of my favorite consumer products, beer. We have accomplished a great deal in the past year and a half. Our very good profit growth in 1994 was driven by an 8% increase in premium brand volume and by a sharply lower cost base. Let me point out just three of our recent successes. We are the leader in the ice beer segment led by Icehouse. Our newest success, Red Dog, is a full-priced premium product and already has broad-based geographic strength. And our top brand, Miller Lite, has slowed its decline, supported by new advertising and packaging initiatives, and we are optimistic that we can improve on this trend. As you all know, industry volume has recently been soft. However, this business has won in the summer. And more importantly, our achievements make us optimistic about the long-term growth of our premium franchises. Outside the United States, the beer industry is growing by about 5% a year, and even faster in Asia and Latin America, where we are focusing our expansion efforts. As we build this business, we expect our international beer income to double by the turn of the century. While beer is a relatively small part of our company, it is a business we like and one we know. We believe Miller will post better income gains than its competitors based on the improvements in light and the success of our more recent new products, coupled with continuing improvements in our domestic distribution system and our international expansion. We will continue to give Miller strong support. Turning to our domestic tobacco operations, I want to say that our business is very vigorous. Our product recall is over, all products are now once again available at retail, and our shipments are matching the historical pattern. And as we have stated, we do not expect the cost of the recall to have any material impact on the corporation's total full-year earnings. The keys to our domestic tobacco profit growth will be our superior volume resilience and premium brand strength, as well as our superb sales execution and operating efficiency. First, I should mention that the decline in U.S. consumption seems to be moderating to less than 2% a year. At the same time, the premium segment has grown strongly over the past 2 years. And as you can see, we have accounted for most of that growth. We expect our total share gains to continue for the foreseeable future in line with our demographic profile and traditional growth trend. Most of our share gains for the foreseeable future should come from Marlboro, given the brand's momentum. We will follow up our hugely successful Marlboro Adventure Team and Country Store continuity programs with other equity-building promotions. You can see why we believe Marlboro has such a great future if you look at Marlboro's most important demographic base, its large and increasing share of younger adult smokers. Actually, this chart shows Marlboro's shares 10 years ago. When we update the chart with the yellow bars, we see that as every group aged, Marlboro's share within the group increased. This means that Marlboro attracts and keeps smokers over time better than its competitors. The yellow bar all the way to the right shows Marlboro's current share of the 18 to 24-year-old market. The future represented by that bar tells us that Marlborough has strong momentum and great longevity. At the same time, we are supporting our other premium brands together with Basic with marketing approaches that promote equity-based growth. We support our brands with the best sales force in the business and a passion for absolute excellence in execution, which our people amply demonstrated by their superb performance during the recent product recall. We are increasing our operating efficiency by continuously improving our production technology, systems, selling, and other functions, and we expect to save more than $600 million cumulatively over the next 5 years. With its unmatched portfolio of powerful premium brands, its amazing demographics, and its superior selling and operating efficiency, our domestic tobacco business should continue to deliver strong earnings growth for a very long time to come. And now to international tobacco, which is our star performer. We are continuing to grow volume and share in our established markets. And we have immense room to expand and improve our business in new and emerging markets. Once again, the trends are with us. The industry outside the United States is growing at about 1% a year. We compete in the industry's fastest growing segment, consisting of cigarettes made of American blend tobacco, and this segment is growing 3 times as fast. We are growing even faster than the segment, and we accounted for 34% of the segment last year, so we are gaining share in a growing segment of a growing industry. You see our strength in region after region. Even in Western Europe, our largest established market, our volume grew by 33% between 1989 and 1994, an annual average of 6% over the 5-year period. And growth has been even more dramatic in our other 3 major regions, the Asia-Pacific region, including Japan and Australia, Latin America, and our newest market, Central and Eastern Europe, where we have moved quickly to secure formidable positions. Our volume gains strengthened our market share positions in each of these regions, increasing our leverage for still more growth. Notice that in the Asia-Pacific region, even after posting a 41% volume gain, we only added 2 share points. Testimony to that total market size and growth, and a good sign of its phenomenal potential. Most importantly, we have translated the volume and share growth into astounding income gains. We more than doubled our income in Western Europe. We more than tripled income in the Asia-Pacific region, where our 41% volume gain was focused in the most profitable markets. And we grew almost exponentially in Latin America and Central and Eastern Europe. One reason we should continue to ride these trends is the fact that we are focused on one of the fastest growing categories within the American blend segment, lower tar products known as LTN. For example, in Western Europe, our 41% share of the LTN category is much higher than our total share, and it's growing as I speak. In Japan, the lowest tar segment has grown to 16 billion very profitable units over the past 3 years, and we have captured almost 30% of that segment, compared to our 14% share of the total market last year. And we expect the segment to continue to grow. Another factor is our progress in the world is the world's increasing preference for major international brands. We have 6 of the top 13 brands. And as you can see, our major brands added 55 billion units last year, compared to minimal or no growth for our competitors' major brands. We are building many of these key brands with new products and geographic expansion in the pattern of Marlborough. For example, L&M has shown strong global potential, and its volume more than quadrupled from 1990 to 1994. In fact, in Russia, L&M is known as Little Marlborough. But make no mistake, Marlborough is the leader by far, and with only 5% of the market outside the United States, it has tremendous potential for phenomenal growth in the years to come. Here is one of the most important reasons we are so confident about our growth prospects. As in our domestic tobacco business, our shares of young adult smokers are larger than our total market shares. This promises continued growth across the board in both established and emerging markets. Here is another way of looking at the future of our international tobacco business. 10 years ago, one out of every 16 cigarettes smoked outside the United States was one of ours. Today, one out of every 9 cigarettes is one of our brands. And in 10 years, we expect one out of 6 cigarettes to be one of ours, for volume of nearly a trillion cigarettes. And if that sounds large, remember that it leaves a huge amount of room still to grow, considering our share in the U.S. today of almost 1 out of every 2 cigarettes. Looking at our strengths and our potential for still greater growth, we believe our international tobacco business is the most robust and dynamic consumer packaged goods business in the world. So to wrap up my discussion of our business, what I'd like to leave you with this morning is that our food, beer, and tobacco growth should deliver tremendous cash to the corporation. And after Murray explains how we are fighting the external challenges facing our businesses, I will tell you how we plan to use that cash to achieve our overarching objective to increase our shareholder value. Thank you, Murray.
Well, thank you, Jeff, and good morning. Over the next several minutes, I will review a few of the major legal issues related to the domestic tobacco industry, and will provide a brief update on our lawsuits against ABC and the Environmental Protection Agency. I know that many of you are already familiar with smoking and health cases, but I believe that it's useful to begin with one historical reference. The U.S. tobacco industry has long lived with litigation, and we have a great record of success. During the past 40 years, over 400 cases have been filed. The industry has never lost a case, and it has never settled a case, a truly remarkable record. As in the past, we are devoting all of the resources necessary to the defense of cases against us. We are also vigorous in prosecuting lawsuits to vindicate our legal rights, such as those that we have brought against the state of Florida, ABC News, and the Environmental Protection Agency. Overall, and I want to stress this, we are optimistic about the ultimate outcome of the litigation in which we are involved. With respect to traditional cases involving claims by individual smokers, these remain quite manageable, as evidenced by the recent hung jury in the Rogers case. We believe that this result confirms once again the common sense view of jurors generally that someone who knowingly chooses to smoke should not be entitled to damages despite claims of addiction. In addition to traditional cases, we are also defending two other types of cases, the class actions and the state Medicaid cases. These cases are primarily the result of two phenomena. First, FDA Commissioner Kessler, Congressman Waxman, and ABC's Day One program last year made a number of false and inflammatory allegations regarding nicotine spiking or manipulation and addiction. Second, plaintiffs' lawyers, who are hoping for large contingency fees, quickly seized upon these allegations in an effort to achieve a result that has eluded them over the past 40 years, a recovery of damages in lawsuits against the tobacco industry. Let me turn first to the class action lawsuits. Three product liability class actions have recently been certified, at least in part, by trial courts. We think that those rulings in Breuen, Engel, and Castano were incorrect under established legal principles, and that we should be able to have those decisions overturned by the appellate courts. In the Breuen case, a Florida state court certified a class action of all non-smoking flight attendants who claim that they suffer from diseases incurred as a result of exposure to environmental tobacco smoke in airline cabins. In Engel, another state court in Florida certified a class of all smokers who have diseases or who died from diseases allegedly resulting from their addiction to cigarettes containing nicotine. Both certification decisions are on appeal to the Third District Court of Appeals in Florida, and we expect rulings sometime later this year. The most recent rulings on class issues came in the much-publicized Castano case, which is pending in a federal court in New Orleans. In Castano, plaintiffs sought certification of a class of all nicotine-dependent smokers. In February, the judge conditionally certified certain issues as common to such a class, but refused to certify other critical issues such as injury, causation, reliance, affirmative defenses, and compensatory damages. The plaintiffs must therefore prove those issues on an individual case-by-case basis. Importantly, the judge also rejected the plaintiff's request to certify a claim for a medical monitoring fund on a class basis. We believe that the judge was incorrect in certifying any aspects of Castano for class action treatment. The judge's ruling raises the specter of tens of millions of individual trials in hundreds of courts throughout the country. That result confirms that this is not a proper case for class certification on any basis, since under prevailing law, class certification is not authorized if individual issues predominate over common ones, or if the trial of the case would be unmanageable. It is difficult to imagine cases in which the predominance of individual issues would be more obvious, or in which unmanageability is more apparent. Last month, Judge Jones granted a motion filed by Philip Morris and the other defendants to allow us to pursue an immediate appeal to the Fifth Circuit of his decision to certify certain common issues for class treatment. Judge Jones also granted our motion to stay all proceedings in the trial until the Fifth Circuit has ruled on the issue of class certification. We regard Judge Jones's decision to certify his ruling for appeal to the Fifth Circuit as an extremely favorable development. We are quite optimistic that the Fifth Circuit will grant the appeal and will not permit Castano to go forward as a class action on any basis. Moreover, if the Fifth Circuit decertifies the class in Castano, we believe the chances are good that the consortium of plaintiffs' lawyers who have initiated this case will lose interest and that the Florida appellate courts will follow the Fifth Circuit's lead in Broin and Engel. In regard to the appeal in Castano, we are also encouraged by the Seventh Circuit's recent decision in Wadley v. Rhone-Poulenc. That case was brought in as a class action on behalf of approximately 10,000 hemophiliacs who contracted the HIV virus allegedly as a result of receiving transfusions of blood furnished by the defendants. The trial judge certified the case as a class action on certain common issues, but left other issues to be resolved by juries in individual cases. The decision was therefore quite similar to Judge Jones's decision in Castano. After taking the defendant's appeal pursuant to a writ of mandamus, the Seventh Circuit decertified the class. The court's opinion, written by Chief Judge Posner, makes a number of key legal points that we are arguing in the Castano case. And it is significant, in my opinion, that Judge Jones, in certifying his class ruling for appeal to the Fifth Circuit, specifically noted the Wadley decision as evidence that there is a substantial ground for a difference of opinion on whether any issues should have been certified for class treatment in the Castano case. Even if any of these class actions should proceed to trial at some point, we still have strong defenses on the merits. The traditional defenses that we have successfully used in the past, preemption, assumption of the risk, contributory negligence, and the statute of limitations, to name but a few, should still be available to us. Moreover, since addiction is the central claim in both Castano and Engel, it is important to remember that there is nothing new in that claim. We successfully defended addiction claims in Cipollone and several other cases in recent years, including Rogers. And we continue to believe that jurors are unlikely to award money damages because of their strongly held belief that plaintiffs could have stopped smoking if they wanted to, just as over 40 million Americans have already done. Now, I'm sure that all of you read last Thursday's article in the New York Times concerning the Philip Morris R&D documents on the subject of nicotine. And many of you may be wondering whether those documents will have an adverse impact on our litigation posture. Let me assure you that, in my opinion, the documents should have no such impact. First of all, despite what the New York Times article suggested, these documents do not constitute a new revelation. They were produced in the Cipollone case, and many others on related topics were introduced into evidence in that case. As you know, the jury returned a verdict for Philip Morris in Cipollone, despite the plaintiff's reliance on internal Philip Morris documents. More broadly, there has been widespread media coverage of our nicotine research over the years. Secondly, as is almost always the case with respect to stories concerning tobacco company documents, the New York Times article focused on research and statements taken out of context and characterized those statements in a manner wholly unjustified by the facts. Indeed, on the afternoon before the article appeared, we advised the reporter what the real facts were, but he chose to ignore those facts and did not even allude to our explanation in his story. We have now sent a letter to the editor of the Times in an effort to get the record straight, and we plan broad dissemination of that letter. To give you but one example of the distortion contained in the story, I refer to the reporter's statement that in the 1970s, the company was conducting experiments to determine how it might reduce tar while maintaining nicotine deliveries at levels that were consistent with the taste preferences of our customers. The story suggested that we were somehow manipulating nicotine for improper purposes. The fact of the matter, which we described to the Times, is that these studies were in the nature of basic research and were consistent with views of researchers and other organizations and individuals outside of the industry, including the National Cancer Institute and the United Kingdom's Independent Scientific Committee on Smoking and Health, which suggested that it might be worthwhile to consider the possibility of reducing tar yields while maintaining nicotine yields. The Times conveniently chose to ignore that critical background. Furthermore, as we have stated on many occasions, we do not manipulate or independently control nicotine yields in our commercial products. To the contrary, there is a tight correlation between tar and nicotine yields across brands, which belie the notion that we artificially adjust tar to nicotine ratios in our commercial cigarettes. That is another fact which the Times chose to ignore, but which I am confident jurors in any case that will be tried in the future will not ignore. Finally, I want to mention another outrageously misleading aspect of the article. The implication that Philip Morris has conducted research on or marketed to 14-year-olds. The study to which the article refers was suggested by the subject matter of a movie entitled Cold Turkey. As in the movie, all smokers in a small town in Iowa quit smoking for a period of time. After that experiment, which was not conducted by Philip Morris, Philip Morris distributed questionnaires to everyone above the age of 14 in the town, smokers and non-smokers alike, to learn about smoking and other activities that occurred during this experiment. The study was not part of a Philip Morris marketing program, and no cigarettes were distributed as part of the study. The article implies that Philip Morris was hiding research involving 14-year-olds. The Times clearly did not do its homework. If it had, it would have discovered that the study was produced in the Cipollone trial, that anti-tobacco activist Richard Denard included the study in a set of documents that he publicly released with much hoopla 7 years ago, and the supposedly secret document, including the statement that the questionnaire was distributed to all residents over the age of 14, was included in the book Smoking Behavior, Motives, and Incentives, published in 1973. The book is available in the Library of Congress, and I believe other libraries as well. Next, I would like to discuss briefly the so-called Medicaid cases. At the moment, there are cases pending in Florida, Mississippi, Minnesota, and West Virginia, in which the states are seeking to recover from the industry the state's Medicaid and related costs which they have paid to treat patients who have diseases allegedly caused by smoking. While these cases present some new issues, we are also optimistic about their ultimate outcome. Mississippi, Minnesota, and West Virginia argue that they do not need to prove that the tobacco industry is liable to each and every recipient of medical expenses paid by the state. We believe, however, that the law requires that the attorney generals must stand in the shoes of each of the thousands of Medicaid recipients whose injuries constitute the basis for the litigation. We therefore contend that the attorney generals must prove causation and liability on the part of the industry as to each such recipient. Further, we believe that we are legally entitled to rely on all of our traditional litigation defenses. An important favorable development in those cases came last month in the West Virginia case. At a hearing on May 3, Judge Berger granted our motion to dismiss 8 of the 10 counts of the complaint. The hearing did not address the 2 remaining counts of plaintiff's complaint, against which we will be moving shortly. In her findings, Chief Judge Berger stated of the lawsuit, I quote, "The public was misled into thinking there could be some sort of huge recovery from this lawsuit. I don't think that's fair to the public, and I don't think it adds any credibility to the legal profession or the judiciary when that happens." We are obviously pleased both by the ruling itself and by the judge's strong language. This should have an impact on the judges in other cases and on other attorney generals who may be considering similar suits. Also last month, in the Minnesota Medicaid case, the judge denied the attorney general's motion to strike many of our defenses and made it clear that we will be able to take discovery of representative individual Medicaid recipients concerning their smoking and medical histories and their awareness of the claimed risks of smoking. A somewhat different situation exists with respect to a statute enacted last year in Florida. The statute authorizes the state to sue for Medicaid reimbursement and it declares that nearly all of our litigation defenses are unavailable. The state filed suit against the industry under the statute in February. We have already taken significant measures to challenge the Florida action. First, we brought a lawsuit last year attacking the legality of the Florida statute itself on what we believe to be very strong constitutional grounds. Later this week, the court will hear argument on our motion for summary judgment on our constitutional challenge. Second, we are working with other industries for the repeal of the statute by the Florida legislature, which I think is an embarrassment to the entire state except for the governor. We had good news recently after both houses of the Florida legislature voted by overwhelming majorities to repeal the statute. The vote was 102-13 in the House and 32-7 in the Senate. The governor has said that he will veto the law, but we are hopeful that the legislature will override the governor's veto when it reconvenes later this year or in early 1996. In any event, the legislature's action should bolster our constitutional challenge to the statute. If the Florida case does proceed to trial under the statute, we expect to be able to have a number of strong arguments against the state's right to recover damages, including the requirement that the Attorney General must prove that individual Medicaid recipients actually relied upon alleged industry misrepresentations concerning nicotine and addiction. As indicated by our lawsuit against the state of Florida, we are unwilling to remain on the defensive and have taken legal action to protect our interests in a number of contexts. In that regard, I would finally like to mention briefly two other lawsuits in which Philip Morris is the plaintiff. As you know, we are suing ABC Television Network for $10 billion over allegations made on day one broadcasts that Philip Morris spiked or fortified its cigarettes with extra nicotine. We contend that those allegations are false and that they were made maliciously because ABC knew that those statements were and are false. We believe we have a meritorious claim, and we have been encouraged recently by pretrial rulings of the court. The case is set for trial in October in a Virginia state court. Secondly, along with RJR and several other tobacco-related organizations, we filed a lawsuit against the Environmental Protection Agency to challenge the EPA's designation of environmental tobacco smoke as a known human carcinogen. We believe that the EPA twisted and distorted the science in order to reach a preordained, politically correct result, and one that is not supported by an impartial evaluation of the scientific evidence. Last month, the court denied the EPA's second motion to have the case dismissed on technical grounds. And now that this procedural roadblock has been removed, we are hopeful that the case will proceed to trial on an expeditious basis. As you can see, we continue to face many legal challenges, but we are optimistic about the final result because of the inherent strength of our legal position. As I indicated at the outset, smoking and health litigation has been with us for over 40 years. It has taken different forms and has come in different waves, but the underlying issues have remained remarkably constant. Whatever form the litigation may take, we remain committed to the full use of our resources in a vigorous defense of the litigation, and we expect to prevail in the end, just as we always have in the past. And now I'll turn the podium back to Jeff.
Well, thanks, Murray. As Murray has shown, we believe that common sense, logic, and the law are with us. We are devoting all the resources necessary to defending our domestic tobacco business. When you are right and when you fight, then you win. We intend to be the world's strongest consumer packaged goods company with the world's best food, beer, and tobacco businesses, producing income superior to most other growth, and I believe the corporation will continue to flourish along those lines. Seven key forces will drive that growth: our continued progress in building the equity of our premium brands, our marketing savvy, especially in new product development, our high shares of growing and profitable categories and segments, our improved product portfolio, especially in food, our vastly superior and expanding geographic reach, our continuously increasing productivity, and our absolute unshakable dedication to making sure we have superior quality, superior technology, and most of all, superior talent in an organizational structure that frees our people to do their best. The real bottom line is free cash flow, or operating cash flow minus capital expenditures and dividends. Let me remind you that our free cash flow from consumer products businesses over the past 5 years was almost as large as the comparable figure for these 10 large consumer products companies combined. And we expect considerably more over the next 5 years. This cash is our primary tool to accomplish our overriding goal, increasing shareholder value. We plan to retain the financial flexibility to deliver great and enduring returns for all our shareholders now and in the future. And that is why we will use our cash to support our business growth, the source of still more cash in the future, to guard our strong credit ratings, to enhance our product portfolio and expand geographically through selective value-enhancing acquisitions, and to take advantage of any outstanding opportunity should one ever come along, to increase dividends at least in line with earnings, and to continue our 3-year, $6 billion stock repurchase program. We firmly believe that this balanced approach between investing in business growth and returning cash to investors is the best and most responsible way to build enduring value for shareholders now and in the future. I said earlier that we are a growth company, and the most dramatic proof of that is the high potential returns from our stock. Just look at how far we've come in a year, up 39% over our price in the middle of June last year, compared to a 17% increase in the S&P 500. Now let's look at what happened since then. We increased our dividend dramatically last August. We announced our $6 billion stock buyback program. We turned in a great earnings performance in 1994. We turned in a great earnings performance in the first quarter of this year, and we're showing every sign of doing well for the full year too. And we've also started to see some positive news on the litigation front. I can tell you that the first three factors should continue to keep our stock growing at a handsome clip. And when you consider the price we'd see if we were just valued at parity with the S&P 500, or if we were valued at a premium as a growth company, then returns could really soar. Obviously, that's a judgment for you and your clients in the investment community to make. For our part, we feel very confident about our business and about our place up there with the best of the growth companies. We believe that's where we belong. That's our vision of the immense potential of our businesses. It's the kind of value our stock should deliver to investors, and I and the rest of our management team will not rest until we get there. Thank you. And now Mario and I will take any questions you might have. So, any questions?
I have a question. In the case, I guess, against ABC, the case against ABC, mm-hmm. Who are you using as outside counsel?
The question is who we are using as outside counsel in the case against ABC. We're using two law firms, one in New York and one in Richmond, Virginia. In New York, we're using the firm of Wachtell Lipton, and in particular, Herb Wachtell, who is a superb trial lawyer. And in Richmond, we're using Hunton and Williams, which has been one of our traditional firms over the year.
Yes?
In the newer countries like Russia, Europe, China, what are the trends in terms of ad valorem versus specific taxation? I guess sort of derivatively, what do you expect will be price rises?
All right. Well, the question is, what is the rate of, or the type of excise tax we're seeing in the tax structures being developed for cigarettes in the newer markets such as East and Central Europe, Asia, etc.? You're right. And also, secondly, what is our pricing views for the future? With respect to the first question on the excise tax structure, we're finding that the trend is towards ad valorem, much the same as you see across Western Europe. But you tend to find a mix. In Western Europe, in the northern countries, you tend to find a higher specific level and a lower ad valorem level. And we're finding in the newer Eastern European states that they're tending to go a bit more ad valorem. You're finding in the Central European states a bit more specific. In Asia, it's tends to be more specific. Japan is, for example, 100% specific. That is a trend leader in that part of the world. So I think you'll find it's more specific there. As to the other question you asked, I can't really comment on pricing. Thank you. You'll understand that. I'm sorry. I wish I could, but I can't. Yes?
Recognizing the excise tax differences, but the margins internationally as compared to the U.S. margins, they're roughly half.
Well, I don't think you're going to see it ever narrow much. The big velocity overseas is the volume rather than the pricing potential, for the reason you described. It's a high-tax area, and much of that part of the world has low disposable income. That's why we've seen for decades price tiers in tobacco, which only came into the domestic market about a decade ago here. But we've been accustomed to three price tiers in most markets overseas, and that's why we are present in all three price tiers. But you will have seen from the presentation this morning, we have very strong representation with our brands, such as LLM and Chesterfield. So I doubt you're going to see much narrowing of the price gap, but I do believe you'll see considerable velocity in volume, which more than makes up for that. Yes?
Can you comment on whether any of the costs from the recall will be covered either by insurance or potential litigation with the supplier of the product?
Well, we haven't got to that point yet. The most important thing for us to focus on was getting the recall executed. The recall was executed superbly. Stock, our high-quality product, is back on the shelf throughout the United States. It was all done in the space of a week. The costs were the order we mentioned in the press release before. It seems to be in the order of $100 million. That will not have a material impact upon our earnings at all. And we'll get to the other issues later, but they're not that significant right now. Yes? Because of the price gap, what was the most important feature of the previous dislocation of the marketplace was the size of the gap. That gap was narrowed substantially in April 1993 and August 1993. I don't expect that gap to change. So I don't expect those cigarettes to become as attractive in the future as they were in the past. Yes, they're essentially in food, but we have made a number of acquisitions in Central Europe in tobacco, as you may recall, in Hungary, in Czechoslovakia, for example, and some in Russia. But the type or the character of the acquisitions we have in mind are similar to those in food we've undertaken in the past couple of years, which I call glue-on or tack-on type acquisitions, where we might buy a $20 million or $30 million coffee company in Poland or Czechoslovakia. And that gives us the ability to get an infrastructure, a distribution system. We bring those people that we acquire and the products we acquire up to our level. Then we bring in our international brands that we paid $18 billion goodwill for, so they're big quality brands. So we bring those into those new geographies. That's where we get an enormous amount of leverage. So that's the type of acquisition that we would continue to have on our radar screen. Nothing substantial, but glue on, tack on.
Take one more question.
Right, one more question, ladies and gentlemen. None? Yeah, Gary, you save time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Phil Morris. Could people please exit over on the left, if possible?
Gary, that's yours, mate. Thanks. Good on you, thanks. Went a bit long, but before we can do a lot of these questions. Hello.
Hi.